You're listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Today's guest, Sean Lillimo.
The guys from Ukraine have been just a home run. Right now, when I talk to them, the war to them is like the weather. You know, it's cloudy with a chance of rockets today. You know, it's just wild. There were times when they had no power for 80% of the day. And they had these big battery banks set up in their house so that they could run their inverters to keep their computer working so that they could keep working, and they wanted to stay working. So they've just been super, super resilient.
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. After you're done listening to this episode, don't forget to share it with others, and please leave a 5-star rating wherever you're listening now. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by Sean Lillimo. He is the head of software development at my firm, Harrity. I wanted to have Sean on my podcast for a long time, but one of the reasons we haven't is because Sean and I have been working on this big project of creating our own task management system within our firm, basically this one-stop hub that everybody at our firm can use to track all tasks and do very easy handoff. It took a little longer than we imagined, I think. It took us kind of about 5 years from the time we envisioned it to the time we finished it. And at the end of this, I said, you know, we got to finally have this conversation about our firm's tech journey, because obviously you've done created a lot of other software tools for our firm. And we could use this podcast also as an opportunity to celebrate this journey. And when I was telling Sean this, Sean goes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you said something like, yeah, I think I created this system for 10% of the cost that it would normally cost, but you might have lost your sanity in the process. So how are you doing?
I think that's a fair rendition.
So we're about a week later. How are you doing? How's your sanity? Is it coming back, or is it kind of a TBD, I guess?
A TBD. TBD on sanity.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Sean, for joining Clause 8. Thought it'd be kind of interesting to kind of go back in time before you join our firm to kind of a lot of people are obviously curious about. We have our own software development team. Our firm isn't even that big. It was even smaller when you joined. And how did we get to where we are? So our firm, we do patent preparation and prosecution. And when I joined about 13 years ago, we didn't operate that much differently from other patent firms. I came from a really big firm. And maybe we were slightly advanced. We were more willing to embrace innovation, but we weren't obviously building it. You know, we had our own. We had the tools for docketing, we had the software tools for time management, but day-to-day process, talking about task management, the way it worked is we had these paper files, these big paper files, each one represented a patent application, and we'd get something from the USPTO, it would be put in there, we'd have correspondence, it'd be printed out and put in there, emails, and each one of these files would be delivered to the attorney's office, and the attorney would look at these files and say, you know, which one's next? And I'll work on that one. And that's how kind of where we were at that point.
And I remember right when I started, this was on the way out, there was a scanner. So you could determine which office the paper files were in. Yeah. And I remember hearing this beeping down the hall. I'm like, is somebody playing a video game? I mean, what is that beeping? And then someone said, oh, no, that's the scanner. I'm like, what's scanner? Oh, so we know which office the paper files are in. So their barcode.
This was at the time you joined. And we had a full-time person devoted to delivering the files. And then kind of going back, the firm that I came from, just the piece where I think we were more slightly willing to embrace technology. So and we'll talk because you actually came from the USPTO, you have a very interesting story, but for electronic filing, that was kind of when I started my career, that was the big thing, the big push from the USPTO. And I think their goal at the time was for 10% adoption. So even though patent attorneys deal with innovation all the time, the USPTO couldn't get 10% filings to be filed electronically. And I remember what I heard at my old firm was, well, the old way works. And the old way involved printing stuff out paying for a carrier to deliver stuff to the USPTO. And we said, that works. You know, why change it? And that was kind of the attitude that you really encountered in the field in general. You were like a real attorney, clerked for a judge. You were working on non-patent issues. And then you decided to join the patent office. Two questions for you is, why did you join the patent office? And what was like the technology like from the vantage point of being an examiner?
Yeah, great question. So my backstory is interesting. I've been making software forever. And it's always been something that I did on the side. You know what I mean? So I had a small software consulting business since I was in college.
Oh, wow. Do you remember that first project? Like, how did you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, the first project was in college, and it was tracking the jobs that needed to be done to fix dorm room things that had gone wrong, you know. So someone's toilet's not working in you know, dorm room 5, and so the team just didn't they had all these pieces of paper everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
So I've been making things electronic for forever, it seems like, you know. So,
were you working for that department, or how did that?
Yeah, so I was just working for the facilities department.
Okay.
in college, and I said, why are you guys doing it this way? Like, nobody knows what's going on. Like, there's stuff going on everywhere and nobody knows what's happening. And so I said, well,
and this was like the late 90s or?
Exactly. Well, it was the early 90s. So,
wow. Yeah, you were the most advanced facilities department,
department ever, right? So super, super, always done that. But I never viewed it as being like a real job because I liked it too much, you know? So it was always just a fun thing that I did. And I made some money doing it, but it was just always on the side. So then went to law school and didn't have an undergrad in engineering. So I wanted to become a patent attorney right when I went to law school. And then I realized, oh, no, you have to have this undergrad in engineering. And so I kind of put that on hold. And so I was clerking for a judge. And then I realized there was this fun loophole in the patent law that if you pass the fundamentals of an engineering exam, you could become a patent attorney. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I'm pretty good at taking tests. So I had a friend who was a physicist who kind of helped me answer the hard questions about thermodynamics and whatnot. And so then I took the fundamentals of engineering exam, and then I was qualified to be sit for the patent bar. So then I got my patent bar passed. And then I realized, yeah, but nobody's going to hire you to do patent law if you don't know any engineering, or if you can't prove that you know engineering. And I thought, okay, then I'll look at the patent office. So I became an examiner. I thought if it was good enough for Einstein, I think I'll give it a try.
So what year did you join the PTO? Just so we like kind of think about the way technology.
So PTO was so funny. I applied and they sent me back a letter that said, you know, hey, you're not qualified because you don't have an engineering undergrad. And so then I sent them back a letter that said, I might have called them. I don't remember. I called them or sent them an email and said, yeah, I do, because this is what the statute says, you know, so I am qualified. And they go, oh, okay, so your interview is Tuesday. I'm like, okay. But that was 2013. So right before the USPTO or the Supreme Court decided, you know, Alice. And I got put in business methods. So absolutely, as soon as I got out of Patent Academy, it was, you know, reject everything.
Yeah, so that's a interesting conversation for another day. Obviously not the most
right.
Encouraging way to join. Did you work patent system?
I thought I was going to be a patent examiner, but I was a patent rejector.
So you're a patent rejector, and you've been creating these tools as early as they existed. Were you guys using technology at the court that you worked at? Was there?
Well, we didn't at the time. So same problem at the Court of Appeals is. So I was at the Court of Appeals of Virginia, right out of law school. And everything was paper filings. And I still remember saying to the judge I worked for, I said, why are we doing this? This is ridiculous. You can't search it. You can't find what you're looking for. This is terrible. I said, we should just scan all this paper that we get sent. So you get banker's boxes of documents and exhibits and stuff in an appeal. And so I still remember, you know, ripping the bindings off of appendices and putting them through this, you know, scanner. And then the judge looks so awesome, right? He'd be sitting up on the bench and, you know, he doesn't have the 15, you know, appendices that everybody else has. He just has his laptop. So everyone thought he was super high tech. But yeah, did the same thing for the Court of Appeals. And by the time I left, almost everybody was electronic.
So you joined the PTO, and you hear a lot about the systems, but you were saying you were involved in developing the new one. So what was like the state of 2013? That was it was pretty recent. You know, obviously, in the internet age, Uber's right. around. I don't know what other cool technology, but Pandora and so forth. For consumers, it's like we're in the golden age of technology usage. And what was it like at the USPTO?
Well, I mean, we still have paper files. Yeah, it's kind of like my career. It seems like, you know, start with paper and end electronic wherever I go. Surprising that it's still happening, you know, this much later.
So the PTO, but a lot of the examiners were remote by that point. So
no, well, a decent number, but they would ship them the files.
Like they would ship them
mail,
the files.
Yeah, they would.
I
mail
never
them.
Knew that.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. So you could.
My
still,
mind is blown. I so how did I miss that?
yeah. Like I had like this the primary examiner that I worked for when I started when I was a junior examiner. He still had a stack of files that he'd allowed or rejected or whatever. I said, why do you do that? Like, why these are also available electronically. He's like, well, it's a good sense of accomplishment. I just measure how much I got done by how high the stack is. I'm like, that doesn't seem like a good use of paper. You know, there's other measures.
It also seems like very, I'm just so curious about this. So when let's say attorney or agent, they file the response.
Yeah.
It would be shipped to the
you could
examiner?
Request that the, okay. That the office and you didn't have to, right? But, but you could request and a lot of people were. They were saying, yeah, send me the paper files. I want to be able, and the big deal at the time was I want to be able to mark it up. I want to be able to highlight it. I want to be able to read it while I'm not sitting in front of a computer. I'm like, okay, well, get a tablet, you know. So anyway, So when I started, it was still a lot, and everyone who's in the office, and you had to be in the office at first, right? When you're a junior examiner, you couldn't hotel right away, and so everyone that was in the office was using paper, and that's how we did it at Patent Academy and whatnot. I doubt that they're still doing as much paper as they were years ago, but so paper, Microsoft Word, EDAN was this custom software that they used to track, you know, where the application was. You know, is this a first office action that you're working on or whatever? Had all the little timers, you know, you had so many days to work on. You had timers running on your first seven cases, right? So you had 50 cases that were assigned to you and the first seven all had timers and none of those timers could go over, I don't remember the day, like 21 days or something.
We were kind of maybe mocking the systems a little bit, but that's pretty advanced. That's pretty
good.
Yeah.
So one thing that you can't criticize the USPTO about is their systems management, right? They were good at generating efficiencies. And I think a lot of that comes from just their business model. Their business model is they're fee-based. They don't work on any tax dollars. And because of that, they have to figure out a way to get the work done in an efficient way. And so they had a lot of really good efficiency tools and they've made them even better since yeah. I was gone. So EDAN got replaced with part of Patents End to End, which is their docketing system. I got to give a lot of feedback to that team. And then they replaced the search tools. Everyone started out when I started with East. You know, you did all your searching in East. I think that's probably pretty rare now. The same database, right? But it's got a new, much more advanced interface on top of it.
All these tools, they were software tools, a long way from when, you know, examiners were using shoeboxes and
pulling
stuff out and pulling out applications.
Yes.
I've had previous guests where we talked about how they used to do that back in those days. Technology really lends itself to kind of, like you said, with the systems and the management that the work that USPTO requires.
And I used to talk to a lot of those older examiners that did do the shoeboxes and really learned that the way that worked was they didn't have a search index. It was their brains. You know what I mean? So you would talk to examiner, you know, Brown, and he just knew everything there was to know about watches. Like the examiner I started to office with at the very beginning did watches and beds, you know, and you could ask him any watch question and he knew the art on that watch question. Or if you asked him, you know, hey, what if I had a bed with, you know, like WWF wrestling ropes around it? Is that new? He's like, oh, no, there's three references that teach that.
No, actually, I just met a couple of examiners. They specialize in mattress pan applications. Yep. And they've been doing it for 10 years. So they know it all.
And then the lady next door was doing shoes, you know. Yeah. It's like she just knew everything about shoes.
And, you know, going back to the conversation where it started, it's the USPTO that was trying to switch to electronic filing system. It's the pushback that they were getting actually from the practitioners about embracing that change. And when I joined this firm, we were actually fully electronically filing, which compared to the firm where I came from, where they were begging the partners at that firm with internally to kind of give it a try and all that, it was pretty advanced. But just a recollection from where, you know, my older brother, he works for a hedge fund, does risk management for them. And I was having a conversation with him and he said, it's easier for me to create a macro than to ask somebody else to do something for me. And he was, telling me all this. I'm like, well, you know, we do this thing that is kind of ridiculous probably to do manually, but, you know, when we amend claims, we strike out things we want to delete and we underline things we want to add. And then we manually remove all that when we need the clean claims next time around. He actually programmed something in like, wrote a macro in 20 minutes, showed me how to work. I was like, all right, give it to me. I came back to the firm and I shared it with everybody. And I think it's actually still in use in one of the tools that we have. But
We copied that macro for our USPTO blacklining tool.
Oh, okay. That's cool. Yep. That experience even taught me, even with myself, if I wasn't using it every day, the power users, you know, the people who are actually our support staff, that was kind of their task to do that. They became big, they embraced it and they kind of did that.
Yeah. Well, because it saves them time, right? I often say, you know, tell me what task you do that makes you want to stick a fork in your eye. And that's the thing we're going to automate first, because people don't want to do mindless work. They want it to be interesting. And
the next big project that I think the software project before Sean joined was, I used to actually keep a spreadsheet with all the examiners I worked with and write their name and like comments, you know, this helped with this examiner, this helped with another examiner. So next time I know, I guess, what works with different examiners. And it was kind of a informally exchanging that information. I don't remember if we kind of used I don't think we actually used like a Google spreadsheet or anything for that, but we kind of knew that. And I think our head of analytics and still our head of analytics, Rocky and John Paul Harity, you know, they, based on that, they came up with an idea for a tool that we still have called a patent proofer, which kind of, it's a more analytics tools and kind of saves your comments.
So funny story about patent proofer. So patent proofer, you pull it up and it gives the examiner a score, you know, how easy it is to get something past them. And it gives, you know, some of their stats and everything. So during my interview with Paul, with John Harity, he pulls my patent proofer up report. I'm like, whoa, you know what I mean? And I was terrible, right? It's like, you know, it's super hard to get something past me. I'm like, hey, it's not my fault. Seriously. It's really not. It's the art unit I'm in.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes you meet a person and they're the person that you meet doesn't reflect their examiner statistics. I never hold it against them.
I thought you were a complete. Yeah, right.
But so we did that tool, and I talked to John when I interviewed him for Clause 8. The impetus before we brought you in is, it's the field that we're in. It's fixed fees, price pressure, and we had to start to think away about, you know, how do we do the same high quality work but more efficiently? It was just like no other choice except to really make the pool of our clients very small, and then we're like, we need some software tools to do that. And I think, from what I recall, Our initial instinct was, let's find something that's good out there and do that. And just what was promised was never what actually was the case when you tried it. And then I think we started looking for you, and you mentioned your interview, but I think you just randomly saw an ad. Is that how you kind of applied?
LinkedIn. And it was super scary for me, because I loved the job posting. It was something about, you know, do you want to automate patent law? And I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, definitely. And I look back at it like an hour later or something, and the Rocky had just taken down the position. And I thought, no, I missed it. So anyway, I contacted the firm anyway, and I said, hey, can I still apply? And I don't remember if it's Rocky I talked to or someone else. But they said, yeah, go ahead and put in your application still.
Did you ever find out why they took it down? I never even heard
that. I think they just, you know, they're like, hey, we've paid for enough impressions. We're going to turn it off, you know? And I'm okay. You know?
Yeah. So. It was kind of like, there was no roadmap. Did you have any trepidations about that? Did you have any fear?
Well, I remember starting and in my interview saying, this is not going to be inexpensive. Like making software is very challenging. And it's not so much the engineering of the software. It's coming up with the right ideas of what to build. And you and I have seen that with Patent Hub.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes the coming up with the right ideas is most of the battle. And then, you know, actually programming it is not that big a deal. I wanted to make sure Harity was committed to investing what it was going to take to get to the solution. And like you mentioned before, you always start with, is there something off the shelf that I can just buy? Because that's going to be way, way cheaper than making it from scratch. That was what I was nervous about. And of course, leaving, you know, a pretty stable government job. But I'm like, okay, no, I'm definitely on board with making a difference.
I remember everybody was talking about your enthusiasm, and it was like you were the perfect person for that role. And you obviously had a lot of experience from both areas to do it. Do you remember the first project?
So I had a test, right? Harity always tests all their applicants, right? It's hard to get into the firm, which is good. It's a good problem. And it was finding out if we could automate IDSs. And so I came up with a solution for automating IDSs. But the first real project that I did after joining...
And automating what aspect of it?
So trying to... let me remember. Because we ended up not spending a lot of time on it after I got hired. Because we found MaxVal, right?
Yeah,
and MaxVal is just a great solution. So we went with that.
Generating.
But it was something to do with, you know... identifying if the office had cited new art and making sure that we had it. But the real project that we worked on, I remember having I missed this day actually. It was a fun day. We had the entire firm at the time in the conference room. It's when we were still in person, and everyone was just throwing out ideas and we were putting on the whiteboard. And what we ended up automating first was claim mirroring, because it was tractable. It's something we could do. And so the first thing we did is we made this tiny little add-in for Microsoft Word to mirror method claims into devices and systems and whatever else you needed that set of method claims to be.
No, so that's interesting, because that is the kind of task where attorneys previously would manually prepare a first set of claims, and then they would copy and paste it, and then they would modify it, maybe vary the scope of the claims. You know, obviously, you know, like different stems. You're sitting there like, come on, why do I need to do all this copying and pasting?
Copy, pasting, and then control F, finding, you know, every word method that you want to turn into the word device, you know. And then, of course, it gets harder because you realize, okay, the system's got to understand a little bit about grammar so that it can, you know, reconjugate verbs and stuff like that. And so, you know, it was a great onboard. You know, we went from simple copying, pasting to using NLP and SPACY and some of the other natural language libraries.
Out of all the tools we were looking for, you know, we wanted the world, but we did find a claim master for doing our proofreading, which was still works really well. So that's an example of, we found something really good, and you know, we used that instead of creating. Our goal wasn't to recreate a wheel. We weren't trying to start a software company. We were trying to just find the best tools possible for our attorneys. So did you write that claim mirroring tool yourself, or like what was the...
So at first we started out, I did a lot of it. At first we started out trying to use freelancers, and that was hit and miss, right? So I remember getting code from freelancers, and I go, I don't even know how this works, right? I'm reading the code and going, this is functional, but it's just terrible. It's not enterprise grade code. So pretty quickly we realized we were going to need to have some full time developers, and so that's when we started looking, and we filled in those roles. And I remember we started one of our first just killer hires was Andre. And he's still with us to this day, and one of the best programmers I've ever met. And so having just really highly skilled people makes a huge difference.
Was a big pain point a part of that communicating what the requirements are and what the tool needs to do? Was it complex?
No.
Like the kind of tasks? What, they don't know what a claim is or anything like that, right, at that point? Or was that the complex?
Yeah, but I'm able, because of my background, I'm able to explain that pretty well. Like, I've been bridging that gap for a long time. So actually, the tools for freelancers are really good, you know, like Upwork or Fiverr or some of these platforms. They have this really great interface to give them the requirements. You know, here's what I want. Here's an example of something that works. I think what it's best used for is just rapid prototyping. If you need a bunch of very different ideas about how to solve a particular problem, I'll still sometimes do that. It's just throw it up on Upwork or whatever and just say, hey, create some software that does X. And you'll get three, and you can charge almost, you can offer almost nothing. It's like, you know, do whatever you can for $500, right? Or $200. Or they'll give you a bid, you know, someone will come back and say, you know, I'll do it for $80. And you go, that's irrational, right? Like I can't even boot up my computer for $80. But then that'll be the one that has the genius idea. And it's, you know, just somebody in Bangladesh or something, and you go, wow, that's genius. So I don't want to diss it too hard, but when you're getting to the enterprise software, you need the continuity of, this is someone who's been here for a year. They understand the software in and out. The freelancer is great for a micro project.
You have a meeting, everybody has ideas, you start picking them out and you realize you need to bring in some full-time developers.
Yep.
How did you find Andre?
So I was just at a meetup, you know what I mean? Just one of these, you know, local industry meetups here in the DC area. And I remember Gary came up to me and introduced himself. And I, you know, I was used to, you know, just different contractors and headhunters approaching me all the time. So I didn't know if this was going to amount to anything. And he sent me some resumes. And I thought, whoa, I mean, these guys are good. You know.
And did you know you would have to, I guess, to make it work, to try to find people abroad?
So we started by looking locally, right? We would rather hire somebody that is close by, but it's just simpler. But at the time, the market was so tight, right? And there were people here that were hundreds of dollars an hour, and they weren't very good. And I thought, okay, well, I need someone that I don't have to babysit, someone who's got a lot of skill. And and so that's what Gary's team really brought to the table, was he was able to bring some very highly skilled people. And as you mentioned, a lot of them are from Ukraine. And I'd never done any work with Ukraine. You know, we'd hired some guys from India, and we'd hired some guys from other countries. And never even considered hiring someone from Ukraine. But the guys from Ukraine have been just a home run.
And this was obviously before the horrible war that's going on there. But you hired them before that. And I think that's an interesting and insane part of the story about how they kept working and wanting to work all through that. Going back, so you did the claymaring. What was like the next, like once you had Andre, what was the next that you kind of put on the list?
Yeah. So then there's like auto abstract, auto summary. Then we just started automating different parts of the specification that we could, you know?
Yeah. So those are part of the applications which you, again, copy and paste. So one of the things, you know, when we demoed this for certain clients, you know, one of the reactions we'd get is like, no, you don't have, you know, the thought and the love. Computer to be thinking about it. We want the pattern turn to be thinking about it.
Right.
But really what we were doing at that point is we were just automating what an attorney was doing manually.
Yeah.
So we weren't replacing what they were thinking, we're just replacing what they were doing.
We got them to where they would have been anyway, more reliably and faster. Yeah, so what you were saying before with claim mirroring is sometimes you vary the scope of the claims. Well, what you don't want to do is vary the scope of the claims by accident because you forgot to copy one of the limitations, you know? And so what we got them was, okay, here's a set of perfectly mirrored claims. And now if you want to vary the scope on purpose, go ahead. You know, it's we're not going to stop you from doing that. So, yeah, I don't know of many people who even noticed you know, that we were using automation tools.
Frankly. Yeah, and they probably wouldn't. And actually, it's a good point. You reduce the errors. You don't only make it more efficient, but you reduce errors you don't want. And obviously, you don't have the tools to do stuff you can't do well.
And if you think about it, if you go into this kind of mode, you can get into a Zen copy paste mode, right? You're in this Zen mode of copy and pasting. You're not doing higher level legal thinking when you're in that mode. So honestly, it probably keeps the attorney in the sweet spot of doing legal thinking a higher percentage of the time.
It's kind of crazy to think about that you have attorneys who are charging on a whatever amount of money, hundreds of dollars an hour, and they're literally, what they're doing is copying and pasting and reformatting and so forth. Like, you know, this is exactly what software is for. You make it sound easy, you know, you did the claim airing tool, that tool. What was difficult in that process? You had to start it all from scratch, developing new tools at a firm. Is there anything you would have done differently?
At the time, the natural language processing engines were not what they are today. They're doing a lot more heavy lifting than we used to do. Like one of the guys that we hired early on, I'm just thinking if there's anything I would do differently, and I'm having a hard time because one of the guys we hired was Kareem, and he used to work for Grammarly. And so he helped us make some of the decisions early on. So we brought in these high caliber people really early that helped us make a lot of really great design decisions. And I feel like we got really lucky on a lot of them. Like we made the right call early on. So I think emphasizing having skilled people in the project was something that we got right almost by accident. I would have transitioned to full-time people earlier, I think, if I had to change something. I spent a little bit too much time with freelancers experimenting and trying to get production quality software from freelancers because we wanted to save money, obviously. So I think that's probably the thing I would do is focus on the team a little bit earlier. But at the same time, you know, I think we needed that time to sort of figure out what are we trying to accomplish.
This is a PPAT podcast, but maybe there's something in the trademark firm that requires this kind of work or copyright on it, or maybe even medical malpractice. And they're like, we do everything the same way we did 30 years ago, or 20 years ago, or whatever.
Yeah. I often say that, you know, the biggest innovation in the legal world is Microsoft Word. You know, it's just...
Maybe another way to ask a question is somebody else is starting from scratch. You know, great advice about in terms of, you know, you want to get ideas from everybody. You want to prioritize those ideas. Don't think you could just rely on freelancers. You'll probably need a full-time team. If you're going to down the journey, you need to commit. Is there anything else in terms of planning and executing?
So I mean, obviously you can't do everything, right? So focus and pick the thing that you think really is going to create the value. If I was talking to myself, you know, trying to start something new in a different space, you really have to, these projects take longer than you think they're going to take. They take years. And so you have to look out and say, is this still going to be valuable 3 or 4 years from now? And if it's not, don't build it. But if it is, then you know, lean in and actually do build it. So that's one of the things that we're having to ask ourselves every day right now, because with ChatGPT and some of the large language models, they may make some projects irrelevant because you've got a software 2.0 way of doing something that skips a few steps in how you would have done it with a software 1.0. kind of strategy. So definitely have a vision that's a few years out, which is hard, right? I think Elon Musk described it as staring into the abyss and eating glass because you're looking at something that doesn't exist yet, trying to figure out how to make it be. And then at the same time, solving the hardest problems that you can think of in order to not crash and burn.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I guess the way I understand is obviously you don't want to devote years developing something that's like a temporary problem, obviously, that's not a good idea. Let's say you came up with a robot to bring the files around. That would not have been a good way to start.
Exactly. It would have been solving the wrong problem.
But also, like, if you know there's probably going to be a tool out there that's going to do it already, probably we don't want to do it. But there's also a piece that I think you're getting in with ChatGPT is we want a solution for this problem. it's important to get one. And maybe if we do it on our own, it's going to take us over 2 years. But while we're doing it, some innovation is going to happen that's going to make it way easier to solve this problem. And if we know that's coming, it might not make sense.
Well, and that's actually the tough call, because if you don't start, then you're just along for the ride in the industry, and you may go extinct in that process, right? So say someone else is ahead of you in solving that problem in some way, it could threaten your entire business model. That's the tough thing, is trying to figure that out, is how do we ride this wave of technology? And I've told many people that I think large language models are they're a bigger deal than the Industrial Revolution. So that's not an exaggeration.
Let's talk about that. You know, your team in Ukraine, can you tell us a little bit about what's it been like working with them, especially over the last couple of years?
Yeah, so I still remember right before COVID hit, I was getting ready to fly over there and meet them all in person. I've never actually been in the same room as any of them, even though I talk to them every day. But then COVID, you know, locked down all the flights and everything, so I didn't go then. And then after COVID was relaxing, then there was the war. So it's been really interesting to watch these guys face these challenges. They're some of the most high caliber people I've ever met. Right now when I talk to them, the war to them is like the weather. You know, it's cloudy with a chance of rockets today. You know, it's just wild.
They have a sense of humor about it.
It's just normal life for them. But you know, there were times when they had no power for 80% of the day, and they had these big battery banks set up in their house so that they could run their inverters to keep their computer working, so that they could keep working, and they wanted to stay working. So they've just been super, super resilient, super fun to talk to.
When the war started, I assumed software development is done until things get better. Obviously, you know, we, as a firm, we supported them. And I remember Sean's like, no, they're still working. They want to keep working. We got to do things on our end to make sure that we provide them with the work. And we just wanted to keep working.
So they got Starlink, you know, when the internet wasn't reliable, or three or four cell phones with high hotspots, whatever it took. I think they missed a week, or maybe 2 weeks right at the beginning of the war. And then the rest of the time they've been full time. It's been crazy.
No, it's crazy. Yeah, I remember when they didn't have power, like you mentioned, you're like, no, they're working in that span of time when they do have power, which is—
They just figured it out.
Insane to think about, yeah. So Patent Drafter was, you know, the first suite of tools. It included all of that stuff for preparing patent applications, the blacklining tool that you mentioned to, you know, convert track changes. And you demoed that at IPO. And the cool thing about it is you actually used the tool and it actually worked. And it's not always the case in the whatever way. What was the reaction that you were getting? I'm sure I was hearing some of that, but you know, I'd love to hear after working on that. First of all, how long did that take?
So IPO was 2019. So it was a little over a year and a half after I started that we demoed.
Relatively the short period of time.
Yeah, pretty quickly. So there was a lot of low-hanging fruit that we just tackled right away. And that's one thing I would highly recommend anyone starting is solve the high value, easy problems first. So we made Patent Drafter, and then we made Patent Searcher, which was a way for us to search our private portfolio. Because you get a client and you may want to know the last time, you know, Inventor A filed an application, well, it might not be public. And, you know, you can't Google patents the private portfolio. So we made our version of that. And so we had a handful of tools in that first year and a half. So we solved a lot of the easy problems, but we started running into the problem that Patent Hub was designed to solve later. And that was all the data in the patent field is highly siloed. You know, so the USPTO has got its data sets. All the different docketing solutions have their data sets. Then there's IFI claims and a lot of these companies that have their data sets. Google Patents has their data set. And, you know, the clients got their system. So everything was super siloed. Nothing's connected. And we found that in order to take Drafter to the next level, we needed to give it more data. it needed to have access to more information. And so we started to build Hub. And then the other problem was a lot of the docketing systems didn't have great workflow management. So there wasn't a great way to keep the entire team orchestrated. And the other thing that we're doing at the same time is trying to create automations, which we call bots, you know, or minions affectionately. If we wanted to create an automation, how does it know what to do? How do you orchestrate all these minions? And so that's when we started digging into Patent Hub, and that's what we've been doing for the last several years. And it's just empowering all these other systems. It makes Searcher better. It makes Drafter better because they're all more interconnected.
That's a interesting part of the story. So, you know, once we transition to getting rid of the paper files, we need a way to track. We obviously have a docketing department. We have a docketing system. So they're on top of everything. But we needed attorneys to have an easy way to kind of see what they need to work on next. And we used basically a spreadsheet for that. And it had its own issues, but it wasn't the most elegant solution. And we went with a inventory, what would you call it, like a task management system where it's very easy to hand off stuff between different departments and all that.
And I still remember creating the spreadsheet, which was something we worked on with our assistants, patent assistants with. And it was a step forward, right? Rather than everyone having their task list on a whiteboard in their office or on a sketch pad next to their desk, there was a centralized spreadsheet. You know, and a spreadsheet's just a database. So it was a step in the right direction. We kind of figured out what we didn't know. And then a lot of those ideas flowed all the way through to Patent Hub. In fact, just the other day, we were doing color coding that matched what they had in the spreadsheet. So
yeah. No, so that's a very good point about minimum viable product. So even if you don't have a software development team, you know, you probably need somebody with Sean's mind. But there's ways to create things to make it easier. Instead of having 30 different spreadsheets, you can have one.
Minimum viable product is critical because you don't know what you don't know. And so if you spend, you know, $100,000 making what you think is going to be this great new invention and it never gets off the shelf, then, you know, it's useless. You're way better off doing a hack in an afternoon and seeing if people like it than, you know, trying to figure out the end at the beginning.
So we have the Patent Drafter tools. We have the Patent Hub system for task management. You mentioned some of the bots, and like bots, we have a bot to help create documents and upload stuff and all that. Is there anything else that I guess sticks out to you? I know we have tools like to save email, tools to easily open the folders that you need, but anything else?
That's the heart of it, actually. What I'm really excited about is what comes next. I don't know if I've told you this, but I feel like the last few years we've been doing plumbing. You know what I mean? It's like you're building the foundation underground. You're hooking up all the lines. You're hooking up all the electricity. That's what Patent Hub really does. Is it connects all these systems and gives you these really large data sets. And it comes at almost a perfect time for us because now that we've got the data interconnected in a way that it's all usable. So you can open a task and know, hey, we also have three emails from this inventor, and we also have, you know, these two documents from the image file wrapper. And we also happen to have, you know, this comment from, you know, whatever, this assistant. You can bring all that information together right now when we're getting ready to train a lot of models, you know, so you need, models are information hungry. So I'm actually excited to be at this juncture where, the plumbing is almost done, and it's time to do something that's a little bit more sexy on top of that, which is, you know, something that's got a large language model as its engine.
So you're saying in terms of it learning what we do, right? So that's a big piece of it. You mentioned ChatGPT, obviously that's a hot topic right now.
So before we get to ChatGPT, the learning what we do is even a little bit more than that, right? So it's learning what we should do in response to like an office action. So an office action comes in and the system can, before anybody picks it up, create a working copy folder, download all the references and create a shell response. And so we've got a minion that does this and we call it response bot. We got all these code names for everything, but so response bot creates that and response bot needs to get smarter. right? So right now, ResponseBot hasn't been trained on enough data to you know, create a really great response. But then at some point, it's going to be almost as good as you know, certainly what good is as good as any assistant could generate, right? When they're making you a shell. And it's going to start to do more and more of the work that the attorney would have to do, suggesting some language. It's like, hey, here's some language from the spec that you may want to put into the claim to overcome, you know, Johnson.
And that's pretty cool. I mean, is that artificial intelligence? You know, people have their own definitions of artificial intelligence.
It really is, right? Artificial intelligence is this huge term that is anything that's intelligent. And honestly, software 1.0 is artificial intelligence, right? So, and the machine learning is a subset of that. Language models are a subset of that, you know, so yeah.
There's obviously, you know, is AI going to replace this profession or that profession? What do you think about patent attorneys? You've seen it from both sides, examination from this side. What do you think the future will look like in terms of all this technology, all this AI? And
So everyone asks me, is AI going to take my job? And my answer is no, but someone using AI will. And so it's going to augment people for the foreseeable future. But predicting more than 5 years out has suddenly become very, very difficult. Nobody I know of, like I've been following AI for a long time, and everyone, including Geoffrey Hinton, who's the godfather of AI, thought that we were 20 years out from where we are today just 2 years ago. And so the timeline has crunched very dramatically with the release of GPT-4. So the future is hard to predict right now. So anybody who says, hey, I'm just going to wait it out and say, you know, I figure out if you know, GPT-5 figures out a way that I don't have to create software. Well, somebody else is going to be working with GPT-4 to make your firm irrelevant if you wait too long.
Yeah. So everybody should be,
I think everybody needs a plan. You know what I mean? You need to have a team of people who are working on this, whether that's a partner or, you know, just a really, really smart tech person that you bring on. Everyone needs a plan of how they're going to ride the wave.
Let's say somebody from a USPTO, the CIO is listening to this episode. He wants to find out, you know, what the greatest patent firm, software development lead is thinks. And, you know, he thinks, you know, we should actually be doing, you said a big problem is getting the data, right? And, you know, USPTO has a lot of that data. What can the USPTO do to help you and other people who want to help IP firms be more innovative?
Yes. Yeah, So I mean, the USPTO is in a challenging spot, right? It's a government agency. There's a lot of people. I can't be too critical at all because the USPTO has been really, really good to us. And anytime we have a concern or whatnot, one thing is it would be really nice if there were public APIs for a lot of their systems. Like their systems have a people first design principle. It'd be great if they had an API first sort of strategy because more and more people are automating, and that's not really a second class way of doing things. It should be like the standard.
And for those not in the software field, API is basically the way, if you build your own software system, that's how you would interact with the other software system.
Yeah, like it's the opposite of a CAPTCHA. You know what I mean? So a CAPTCHA is, am I a robot? You know, and if your system is trying to close itself to automated systems, it's just a little misguided. I don't want to be too critical, but the worry is if we don't stop robots from talking to our system, the robots are going to overwhelm our system.
Yeah,
and you know, they're just going to ask for too much information.
Yeah, or bad, you know, actors, I mean? Right? There's bad, right, actors who are obviously going to try to bring down the USPTO for whatever reason.
And this is one thing that I have to give the USPTO huge kudos for is they have other trust mechanisms, right? So if you have two-factor authentication or whatnot, then you can establish trust with the USPTO, And then they don't try and shut you down when you're accessing their systems in an automated way. So huge kudos to them for that. So that's super, super helpful. It's great to have dialogues with them to see what matters to them. One of the things that we've been trying to think of is ways that we can offload some of that traffic from their servers. So let's say someone wants the entire patent data set, right? You know, all the published patents. They have some published data sets that you can download, but a lot of people still try to scrape that from the USPTO. And so we've been trying to think of ways to make that data set more publicly available so that so the USPTO servers don't have to deal with that traffic.
Sounds like a win-win.
I mean, we really want to be good stewards of their system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we sort of exist at their good graces.
I think everything that we've done, we've been very transparent. I think we've kind of adopted that. And I'm not just talking about interacting with the USPTO. Obviously, that goes without saying. But also, you know, the tools we're creating, the stuff we're thinking about in the future, how our tools work. There's no magic sauce. You know, we're happy to kind of talk about it and kind of explain. We do that with our clients in the way that I put it. We do it with the USPTO. We do it with the other firms. And everybody who's interested in going down this path. Maybe one last question. It's a kind of variation on what I was asking before. There's people listening and they're like, all right, this is great, but this sounds like a huge headache. Even if you made it sound much rosier than I think it was. It's not easy. It takes a lot of work. And it takes a lot of commitment. It takes finding a great team that makes you do it. As I mentioned, it takes not going completely insane trying to make it work and keep it on the air. You know, everybody has ideas. You know, everybody had ideas from that first moment. Everybody has ideas at the same time. People are prioritizing it. Things don't always work. But somebody's listening to this is like, this is a lot. And you said everybody should be thinking about it. But realistically, another firm out there, and let's say another patent firm out there, and somebody's thinking, I have these ideas, but is it realistic for me to start my own software development team within my firm? Is that something really realistic? Or am I just going to hire somebody and waste a lot of money and not get anywhere?
No, you can waste a lot of money. There's no doubt. And so not wasting a lot of money is important. But I think your anecdote from earlier on was an important one. You can make a macro, right? Or someone you know can make a macro to do something that needs to be automated. Or you can, you know, use a language model. You can figure out a language model that you can interact with. There is something you can do. I'm not saying you need to hire an entire team of developers. That's probably not where you start, right? You start with something discrete and valuable and small. And what you definitely don't do is nothing. Nothing is a recipe for disaster in this space right now. That wasn't true a decade ago, right? You could just go around business as usual for the past 50 years up until just recently without a huge negative impact to your business. But what happens when your competitors are three or four times more effective than you are? That is now business relevant. So even if you don't know where to start, and in some ways the smaller firms have it easier than the bigger firms. They don't have the institutional inertia to fight, right? It's just like, hey, I'm thinking about doing X, and you go, okay, let's try X, and you can maybe hire. I just thought of something I would do differently. Don't hire when you're just starting out really inexpensive, inexperienced developers. We started out by trying to save money by hiring a bunch of really inexperienced people and figuring, you know, hey, we might get lucky. No. So find someone who just comes really highly recommended, or if you know how to determine they're really skilled.
Yeah, I mean, if you do this, don't.
Yeah. Don't hire a bunch of interns to to try and change your entire business model.
So let's say you start doing those little things And let's say some work, some don't work, but like you're trying to consider whether you can be serious about supporting a software development team. Any guidance about that?
The business value is always hard to establish, right? So what is the actual value of creating a piece of software? usually it comes down to some competitive advantage that it gives you. Either you're more efficient or your quality's better or both. So quantify the value at the beginning. So if we create claim mirroring, for instance, how much time is that going to save? All right, how much time do our attorneys spend mirroring claims? You know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour? I don't know. We need to figure that out. Okay, so we make this once and the attorneys keep using it for a year. How much money does that save? And then anything beyond a few years out is pretty speculative. So I wouldn't say we're going to amortize the software over 20 years. It's just not realistic. So pick a project that you think can realistically be done in a few months and figure out how much value it would probably create and throw it out there. And you'll learn something in the process that guides you to the next project.
Very good advice. Keep building from there.
Oh, yeah. You will not run out of projects. Like we started out with a one whiteboard of ideas, and now I have thousands of ideas that have been submitted that are somewhere in the ranking priority list. And people on the regular basis ping me and say, hey, where's my idea on the list? It's like, it's pretty far down.
Yeah. It's something you mentioned, actually. Even within a project, sometimes you ask for feedback.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of good ideas because when people are using these tools, they get excited, they love it, and they're like, oh, but this other thing that I do, it'd be great if it did it. And it is.
And it snowballs and it starts to create its own momentum.
Right. So it's like that is actually a learning experience, I think, for our firm in terms of how to prioritize and how to
honestly,
put in the funnel.
when they first hired me, they thought, how much work do we really have for Sean, right? Like how long can we keep him busy? Yeah, he'll probably automate everything and then we'll have to lay him off or find him something else to do. I have no fear of that.
Yeah. No, it's a good way to put it. It snowballs. Like as soon as you develop something, there's always room for improvement and there's always kind of adjustments and things.
And if it wasn't creating value, we wouldn't keep doing it. So you continue to find things that are high value projects that add to the firm.
And as I guess as a coda to the PanHub story, you know, we kind of had to take people on an emotional journey as well to say we're going to get rid of the way we did things and embrace this new way. And there's no going back. And this will be a day. And I think to the very last week, people wanted to kind of push back the timeline, but we ended up pushing.
And then what invariably happens is you hear from them a little while later and they go, this is really great. You're like, I know. That's why I kept pushing you to do it.
No, well, yeah, that's the story. Even now, you know, we get feedback, this not working, not working. They're like, oh, by the way, this is awesome. You know? once embraced, it's a great feeling. So, Sean, thank you. Without you, it wouldn't have been. Everything our firm does wouldn't have been possible, and this episode wouldn't have been possible. So thank you for coming on Clause 8 and telling the story.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.